Our greatest glory is not in never failing, but in rising up every time we fall. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic family. I'm a recovering alcoholic myself. And today is my birthday, y'all. Today is my 37th birthday. What the fuck? We curse here. You've been warned. Yes, 37 years old today, and just very honored and grateful to have spent another year around the sun as the host of this podcast and the captain of this shit show ship. Very grateful and appreciative for each and every one of you out there listening, especially those who have been there since the beginning. You guys mean the world to me. So here's to 37. We're getting a little too close to 40, folks. We're getting a little a little too close to 40, okay? How old do you guys feel? Like, I feel like I am, let's be honest. Like, there's some days that you feel like you're like 12, right? But I would say I feel like I'm 27. I think that's how I feel. I feel like when I think of myself in my head, I think of myself as like 27. What about you guys? So welcome aboard this hot mess of a ship. As I've already said, we curse here. You've been warned. I'm an acquired taste. You've been warned. And today, folks, we are diving deep with returning guest. I think she's actually been on the podcast more than any other guest. And rightly so, as she is the one of the pioneers of the adult child movement, Miss T.N. Dayton. We all should be so damn grateful to this woman because she put words to the experience that so many of us have had. She was calling this shit trauma before anyone else was. She's granted us the gift, the opportunity of healing, and I'm so incredibly grateful to her. So she has a new book that is coming out on March 1st. It is called Growing Up with Addiction, How Adult Children of Addicts Can Heal Family Trauma, CPTSD, and Codependency. It is on pre-sale now, so go down to the show notes, pre-order this shit. I have read it. It's a banger. And just when I think that we're going to run out of things to talk about, nope, folks. This is probably my favorite conversation with her to date. And I also got her to share something that she had never, she's never shared publicly. So the vulnerability whisperer was back at it again. You know, I was out to dinner this past Friday night. I went to dinner. I was sitting at the bar and I was talking to this couple next to me, and they had been married for 30 years. And so, of course, as I do, I'm like asking the deep questions. I was getting in there, just asking about what their experience has been and being married 30 years. And at a certain point, the guy looked at me and he goes, in the middle of like, you know, sharing something quite personal. And he goes, I don't even know your first name. And I said, yep, that's what I do. That's what I do. So on that note, let's just get on with the damn show. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Jordan Shit Show, my online support community, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is the spot to be, folks. This is where healing happens. You'll hear Tian say in the interview that it is so important to be a part of a community, to be amongst peers on this healing journey. And guess what? The shit show is the funnest place, the best and the funnest place to do so. So you, who's been wanting to join for forever, how about we do it today for Andrea's birthday, okay? That could be the best birthday gift for me and for you. So go to the show notes, or you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. So do it already. Okay, let's just do the damn thing. Next, give me a follow on Insta, on TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, if you want to give me another birthday gift, could you please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify? Really appreciate it. Thanks, love you all. All right, folks, she's back. The woman, the myth, the legend, Ms. Tan Dayton with her newest book, Growing Up with Addiction, How Adult Children of Addicts Can Heal Family Trauma, CPTSD, and Codependency. Welcome.
Nice to be here. Nice
when does it come out?
March 3rd with St. Martin's Press. And it's now on Amazon, Barnes and Noble.
So you can pre-order it.
Yeah, you can.
Okay. It's really good. I am curious, when you wrote this book, and also when you just write books in general that are not for practitioners, but are written for the adult child, do you ever have like a specific reader in mind? Like, was this for somebody who is kind of just starting out on their healing journey or just starting to connect the dots, or for somebody who maybe is further along in their healing?
That's a great question, Andrea, from your experience in this space. You know, I wrote Emotional Sobriety, and that hit a chord and sold so well. And it was about ACEs, but it had a broader reason to be. Then I wrote the ACOA Trauma Syndrome, which you know. And I always was concerned that that was really for the anointed ACA or the professional. You needed to be along in your path to understand that, or it could be sort of activating.
What do you mean by the anointed ACA?
The one who's really done part of the work.
Okay.
I wanted to launch people into the seriousness of this. So when I wrote Growing Up with Addiction, it was, as you figure it out, with a different goal. It was, and asked by Sounds True, now acquired by Macmillan, they wanted it for the general reader. They didn't want it to be for therapists, and they wanted it to be very, very accessible. And that is the book I wanted to write, something to really talk to somebody who's considering it, somebody who's maybe a little 12-step worried, not that you have to be in 12-step, but someone who doesn't know what's the point in going near this material on the inside, why feel this stuff, and someone who could relate to cognitive distortions, attachment wounds, but hadn't necessarily pieced it all together. And then a big piece of the book, which I hope you sort of picked up reading it, is that recover or repeat. You know, if you don't recover, these wounds will become intergenerational. You'll parent differently. You'll partner differently. And there's a way out of this. So you have a choice. And also the other point is this is a serious disease. We can't take this lightly.
So true. I liked how much you wove in the nervous system.
Well, that's the other thing. You're hitting all the right tones. I have really created a model that psychodrama, right? You know psychodrama, and many ACAs know it from treatment. But it's very activating if your nervous system isn't stable enough to handle it. I adore psychodrama, but I needed and have needed since the 80s when I've been doing program development, a way to work with trauma that first regulated the nervous system and then introduced the more potentially activating work on personal history, attachment wounds, etc. So I did this slowly over the last 30 years. And the result is that I have a model that addresses trauma historically and also builds resilience and lets you feel good about yourself and the path you're on. So the nervous system is sort of a ground zero for that. And people are getting that point. They're understanding polyvagal. They're understanding Steve Porges' work. They're listening to Deb Dana. I've also integrated Peter Levine's somatic experiencing, and that gives the body a voice. You know, Bessel's book, The Body Keeps the Score. Trauma is stored in the body. And if we can tell a great story about our traumatic past, often as ACAs, but it doesn't do us any good when it comes to healing. We have got to excavate that frozenness and that nervous system dysregulation and give it a way to heal. And I know how to do that.
I think that's the first time I've seen you reference Deb Dana in one of your books. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, especially over the last year, it's like, I've understood that the body keeps the score, but I haven't fully like understood the ways in which my body has kept the score, and in particular just that stored survival energy, like in particular just not realizing how much I live in a constant state of low-grade hypervigilance, because it's like it's all and so I think a lot of the times I've thought about it from the perspective of like when it results in autoimmune issues or horrible chronic pain, which eventually it did lead me to that. But like it can be really hard for people to come to grips with just that stored survival energy in the body unless something sort of dramatic happens. I think it can be really easy to kind of just dismiss it.
You are so right, Andrea. You are so right. We live from crisis to crisis. And until our life explodes, we don't realize we've got a problem, something we have to get help with. And that drives me nuts as a person who's been shouting from this message for so long, because I want to spare people that kind of unnecessary pain and passing down that unnecessary pain to their children and blowing up relationships that might otherwise be more workable because they're not able to own what you're pointing to. May I ask you, since you brought it up, may I ask you a personal question?
Of course.
How did it show up in your body?
Neck and shoulder. I mean, I literally have been living with my shoulders to my ears, and I have dealt with neck pain and shoulder tension for years. And, it hurt, but it was not as painful to where I could still kind of push it aside. And I've been doing this work for forever. And not once did I ever consider that this is my trauma until it gets to the point where, I do something, my arm is like numb for over a month, and it's like it's mind blowing. But it's interesting when you say that point of like spare people the pain. Gosh, I think I'm just one of those people, and so many of us are like where unfortunately requires that massive amount of pain.
Well, we're used to the pain. We're
Yes.
ACAs. We're used to, from my own personal experience, I don't feel like I'm doing enough unless I'm doing too much. I mean, my enough is another person's too much. So that's my
True.
resting place. And I think we're that way with pain. We're that way with what we can tolerate and dysfunction in our relationships. I have a very high threshold for pain of every kind. But I think that our high threshold for dysfunction, so that we don't back up from, what happens with somebody who's, normies or, they'll go, "That's really weird. I don't know why. I don't know what's, but that's just kind of weird what he did." They would know what weird is. So they have a category for that. Our category was completely obliterated as ACAs. We don't know how to say that was really weird because we grew up in really weird, weirder. And so we have this, we stretched our boundaries of normal. And on the one hand, that makes us creative, ingenious, zany, fun, talented, right? We can draw from zones that other people avoid. That can become a superpower. But we need to learn to use it so it doesn't use us. Otherwise, we just keep recreating the same dysfunction. And then the artist's dilemma of thinking you have to be a little nutty to be creative. And, that's a, I know that one.
How did trauma manifest in your body?
Oh, how did it? Where do I begin? Let me count the ways. I had stage four cervical cancer at 35.
I never knew
When
that
I
about
had,
you.
oh, that's not even the beginning. I had something else. I'll try to remember what it was. Then when I was operated on, which they did, of course, immediately, The 2 hour operation stretched to 5 because they found so much endometriosis. I was left with a half of one ovary, and my husband, of course, at that was, I'm sure, we haven't even talked, I haven't even asked him, but I'm sure they were constantly coming out saying, do we have permission to this? Do we have permission to that? And thank God, I'll ask him or thank him for giving it because I didn't have any further treatment. So that's one.
How old were your kids at that point?
They were in third grade and, going into kindergarten.
So for you to be at stage four, did they have any sort of idea of how long you had had this?
No, and it was a total God shot that I was cured. I told a friend, I said, look, I'm feeling like this and what, and she said, oh, let me think about that. I do know somebody. And then she looked at me and she said, no, let me give that to you right now. And she took out this, we used to carry these enormous books around in our bags with everybody's phone number. She took it out and she said, this doctor is incredible. You've got to go and see him. And I did the same thing with another friend. And she looked at me and she said, I don't want to sound funny, but this is what my friend said before she found out she had cancer. And I just listened. And I called that number and I went to this doctor, and it didn't show up on any of the tests. Nothing. And he looked at me and he just said, something in my mind, something in my mind. I'm going to give you a DNC. And he saved my life. And I still see him and I still thank him.
Wow.
So that's how that happened. And my children. I'm an ACA when I tried very hard to get normal and so tell them in a very nice way. And I did. And, my little boy said, what's that? What's cancer? And my daughter said, but I have the Christmas concert. And I said, I already thought of that and I asked permission and we can stay. And then she said, but what about the pizza party? And I said, I asked about that too. And the doctor said, I mean, my doctor literally looked at me, if this is not ACA, when I told him about first about the Christmas party before I digested the cancer. He said, I just told you you have stage four cancer. And I said, I know, but my daughter's Christmas party, Christmas concert. And he said, okay, you can wait till this was like waiting 2 days, but not one day more. And I said, what about the
The
pizza
pizza
party? He said,
party.
stop it. And then I've had, other things too. I have immune issues sometimes, little allergies to things. But that got me into recovery, that illness. I was already in recovery. I was already in the rooms even, but it got me to realize how serious.
Jeez. Wow. Always
And
learning
it changed
something
my
new about
life.
you.
It's when I really got serious about being a therapist working on these issues and talking about them.
Wow. I'm curious, when it comes to the dysfunction manifesting from alcoholism or addiction as opposed to other forms of family dysfunction, do you really feel like there is that much that is particularly unique when it comes to either like in impact challenges or navigating the healing journey when it specifically is alcoholism or addiction related versus other forms of dysfunction that cause complex trauma?
This is why I love doing your podcast. You're just so good at this.
Thank you.
You are, and I've been with you for many years, and you have just every time you get better. Not that you were always good, but it's yours. And yes and no. So yes, it is different, and no, it is not. Tolstoy's line, every happy family is happy in the same way, but unhappy families are all unhappy in their own way. I found unhappy ACA families to all be the same in my years as a psychologist, my years as a family member with ACA relatives in every direction and friends. I think that the uniqueness of growing up watching a parent you love descend into alcoholism or drug addiction is one of the most mind-bending, heart-wrenching, heartbreaking experiences you can have. It has no beginning, no middle, and no end. And you can try all you want, but that drug will win. Until somebody changes their own life, you are caught in a swirl of darkness and ghost-like reality, alternating with the life of the party and this close, attentive, warm presence. And it is so confusing and disorienting and disequilibrating that, yes, I think ACAs get very sick and we don't know it and we won't name it. And what we pass on is worse than what we got for this reason. My husband's an ACA, I'm an ACA, all my siblings, all my in-laws, friend, oh, many friends. And we had an addict to point to. We could say, because I live with this, I am this, they say in these books. So I'm going to give it some thought. What the grandchildren grow up with is our telling them how hard we had it and how much better they have it. And so, because we are completely unconscious of our own pathology, we pass on the residue of addiction without knowing we're doing it while telling these kids how lucky they are. And they have no one to point to. They just, you know who they point to? Themselves. They point to themselves. We did too, but they do more. So that's the different of alcoholic piece or drug addicted piece. Where it is the same is that all kids who grow up with relational trauma, not trauma, event trauma like a war, but relational trauma, may be getting abused sexually, may be getting abused emotionally, may be getting abused verbally, may be diminished, maybe have their parents' issues projected on them, maybe grow up with narcissism. But I think addiction is narcissistic too. Growing up with a narcissistic parent is traumatizing daily. But they may not be an addict. However, they may produce addicts because trying to get love from a narcissist is enough to make anybody want to drink or drug.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So my episode last week, I had on this psychologist. His name is Dr. Peter Salerno, and he's most known for his viewpoint that a person can develop a personality disorder without enduring any sort of trauma. I'm curious, like, one, if like what your thoughts are on that, but what was particularly triggering for me in the preparation of the interview is that in both of his books, every time that he is saying complex trauma, complex PTSD, he's then defining big T, like
Like event trauma?
trauma. Yeah, and then listing the symptoms of just general PTSD, and then always excluding the symptoms of complex PTSD that would be the symptoms that overlap with a personality disorder. But I'm curious, do you have any strong opinions as far as like, does personality disorders always include some element of trauma?
Well, I mean, I think my thinking would be aligned with yours that, it took me a long time. I've been in this field for 40 years, and we all thought event trauma was the trauma. But inside of me, I knew what you knew as a young woman who was traumatized in relations. So I started writing in my books, relationship trauma. And then, a few years into it, I started seeing it all over in the field. But one of the first people to write about it was me in Heart Wounds when I said that the impact of unresolved grief and trauma on relationships, because I saw it. And I remember saying that to my editor, and he said, "That's not a chapter, that's a book." And I said, "Yeah, we'll do this book sometime." But then I got all involved in wherever I was all involved. But The relational trauma, the flavor of it, the nuance of it, this is trauma that is happening to you from the people. You have to, let's dial it back. Can we dial it back?
Please.
Little children, right? Anyone who's raised a child with sensitivity, anyone who's now as a grandparent and has more knowledge and sensitivity and wishes they'd done this and that differently, can see the impact of the personality, the behavior, the feelings resolved or unresolved of the parent on the child. Parents shape children. Every little interaction between the parent and child actually builds the nervous system regulation, builds neurological development, because babies come out of the womb soon without that full development. Otherwise, they'd never make it through the birth canal. They'd have to be. So that a lot of the development of the child's nervous system goes on after birth. That's why children really need this marsupial kind of parenting. They need body contact. They need to respond to polyvagal, Stephen Porges, to our tone, to our attentiveness, to the quality of our holding. Are we nervous? That means that they're going to observe nervousness. Are we calm? They will observe calm. Are we using a voice like that on them and talking at them as if they're across a room? Or are we, when you have a baby, you know this, because some people come and meet your baby and go, "Hey there, Buster," or "You got a little baseball player there?" And meanwhile, there's this little infant. So this development that happens when they're small, or the connection, the ability to connect relationally, deeply, is a language of love that begins with gestures. It begins with screeches. It begins with holding. That's how the emotional language starts. Little babies tell us what they want through how they point, or how they, do they laugh? Do they smile when we hear them? Do they cry because we've cut them off? That's traumatic for a baby, to feel unseen, to feel put down when they need to be held, to feel ignored, to feel passed off as if they were a pillow, or to not be read as the sentient, alive, developing being is traumatic. That's relational trauma. And just keep in mind, they have no language. They can't get it. They're trapped, completely trapped. They can't fight, flee, or fight. So what do? They dissociate. They shut down because they can't defend themselves. The people that are in charge of their world hold the keys to everything. The money, the house, the food, the car, the everything. So we are, as babies and children, totally dependent. That's where we learn what it means to be human, or what it mean, and what it means is a variety of things. So that's the kind of the backstory answer of that, if it helps.
It does help. Another good segue, you mentioned dissociation. So in this book, I don't know if I've seen you write at the length that you did in this book regarding process addictions.
Yeah, right.
So one thing that I talk about on the podcast, which I don't like talking about, but I do talk about it, is I've struggled with over the past, I don't know, 8, 10 years with phone addiction. And as somebody who's 17 years sober from drugs and alcohol, I think it can really be easy to not fully grasp the impact of a lesser of two evils addiction. And so I'm curious, how much do you see process addictions interfering with the healing process?
Well, what you said earlier about the person who thinks if you don't know it, it's not really there. You'd start with a sentence, what you don't know can still hurt you. In fact, what you don't know, what remains unconscious, is precisely what does still hurt you and what really hurts the next generation. you may not know it and feel kind of bitter and kind of like you got it figured out, but you'll still pass down the undertow, and it'll nail your kids. I think it depends on the severity. Those process addictions are really on an arc. I think everybody in our culture is a little bit addicted to phones,
Technology,
screens,
yeah.
to technology, and we're figuring that out slowly. But I think for children addicted, it is they don't learn to be in the world. They learn to be online. They learn how a cartoon person relates to another cartoon person. They don't know how to relate to real people in real time. That has remarkably serious implications. And the other process addictions, gambling is just another subject entirely. So hard to treat. And I don't
Really?
fully, very hard to get a gambler to stop gambling.
Wow.
Easier to get, the one I have the most trouble with is anorexia. That's a tough one to break through. It's so socially reinforced, thinness, beauty, and until you become scary, and people are telling you how pretty you look.
Yeah.
But overeating is, and now of course with all these shots, that's a changing world. But it's easier to for me to treat. Sexual addiction, easier to treat. You see it. It's hard to deny acting out sexual behavior. It's hard to deny large body, that something is getting out of control there.
Any theories on why gambling is so hard to treat?
No, I haven't thought about it enough, studied it enough, or worked with gamblers enough to have insight worth giving to. I'd be guessing, and I'd be you'd guess would be as good as mine. I mean, the only thing I would throw into that is that what makes a process addiction addictive is the dry high, right? The anticipation. That's the hook. I'm gonna give myself a reward because I was so good today, and I'll walk by that bakery, and I'm gonna get to watch this, and now I've got my device in my hand, and I'm feeling better already. What are some other examples? It's just the same as
Shopping.
a drink to celebrate, a drink because you're depressed. So, what's it, the addiction is in the mind until you pick it up. And that's wired in our biology. And if you don't interrupt that, you go into the action. So I'm guessing gambling has that quality, but maybe gambling has it with so much promise. Promise of money
Yeah,
and
that's
bright
true.
lights and
The
bright scents.
reward, the potential reward is a very extreme.
And maybe, isn't every Las Vegas hotel lobby set up to, I mean, I can't stand it personally, walking through with all that loud sound and the dead looking people going like this. And but I think for some people that is seductive, and they have, what do they give? Low hotel rates,
Free drinks.
free drinks, expensive food, and you can't find your way outside. I mean, I've been at so many conferences in Las Vegas, that, once you get in, if you can get out, you have to, like, if you can find your way out of a hotel in Las Vegas, you've got a good sense of direction.
It's interesting how, like for people with addictive
They
personalities.
disorient people. Sorry, they
Yes. Yeah.
disorient
And
people.
well, and also too, like I mean, I think there's stuff with like the temperature that they keep it in. There's like so many different things that factor into
Yeah.
it. Just the amount of psychology like that's gone into planning and designing these things. It's interesting how like with people that have addictive personalities or tendencies, how certain things they cannot have a problem with, and other things they can.
What do you mean?
As far as like somebody who is an alcoholic or an addict, but they don't like they're not prone to like gambling addiction or to food, you know, just how certain
Preference.
preferences. So when it comes to dissociation, though, I'm curious when do you feel like dissociative coping crosses the line into a process addiction?
I'm not sure I would consider dissociation ever a process addiction. Are you thinking of it as such?
Well, I mean, I think that like when I'm zoning out on my phone, I think that being on my phone is a form that's like me dissociating. So a form of me checking out. I
You
would
know,
think
I
that
have
like
to think about it a
I would
lot
think
too.
anything like, you know, I think we could use a lot of things like for I think food could be a form of dissociation. I think, yeah.
Well, certainly people who are checked out when they're doing those things, and it is dissociative. I tend to think of dissociation as a category in and of itself that has to do with the mind, but it these are activities on their way to dissociation. I'd need to give it more thought. I don't mean to pass that off, but I think what goes through my mind, and I have to give it some thought, is that when you're going to a phone or to food or something like that, it allows you to dissociate, but you are going somewhere. That over time, when the action becomes completely unconscious, then the dissociation is set in. I was sitting in the back seat of a woman who was driving me somewhere, and what she brought with her for snacks was a bag of marshmallows, or these orange, what equivalent of marshmallows. I mean, it was just almost unbelievable that that was what was going to sustain her during a long drive. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm bringing apples, and, you know, so when I just was in the back seat and I had this front row view of when she would reach for that. When there was traffic, I would say, gosh, how much, what do you think about this traffic? And I would watch her hand and go, oh, well, little da 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 da. And then I watched, you know, there, and it was dose specific, you know, two marshmallows took care of this, three marshmallows. Was it a five marshmallow jam? Or, and the, every time there was a subject that was brought up, or a, you know, something anxious making to try to get an exit, anytime there was some kind of anxiety. So that is a, for me, one of the clearest examples of the dissociation crossing over mid reach, you know, somewhere along here it went unconscious. So yeah.
Do you think that there is a certain level of dissociation that is required in order for someone to start healing? I'm not sure if that makes sense, but like,
I
do you
think
know what I mean?
we're playing with words. You know, it was somebody interviewed me the other day, and in part of our prep, she said she used the word dissociated a lot, and I told her about she was referring to a time because we'd done a lot of pre-interviews that I was in my home when I was a teenager, and it was we went from 6 to 2 in a very short time, so I spent time alone. And one thing I did in order to stay sane, really, if I was cooking, I had a kind of a mental game I played, which was be as efficient as possible. I always want to make use of my time. So I thought this is a good training ground for efficiency. I will make sure I have as few trips across this large kitchen as possible. In other words, if I need flour, sugar, and you know, baking soda, I'm going to get it on one trip. I'm going to organize in my mind and then execute it. And I could see that from above. I could, and you could call that dissociation, but it was as clear, the lines were orange, I could see them, and I could see little tags along the lines as to how many things I needed to get. And if I didn't get them, I'd be really mad at myself. But would we call that dissociation when I'm conscious of it? The mind's ability to go places. In Vietnam, soldiers talk about building castles in their mind, but they do it with great precision. They have, so they're dissociating. They're using a capacity of mind, but they're there consciously. I'm not sure if I would. I think the
So how
word
would you define dissociation?
I think it's a capacity of mind to go towards another realm. In my mind, if you're conscious of it, you're visiting another realm, like a yogi would. And if you're not conscious of it, if it's this part of the reach to the marshmallows, it's dissociation. If you're using it mindlessly, but anything, that's where ACAs can become very spiritual, because we are forced to visit states of mind that we would never choose to go to if we want to stay connected to a drunk or addicted parent. I mean, if I wanted to find my father where he was, it was where angels fear to tread. It was horrible. But I was his child, so I went there naturally because I'd been groomed to go there, right? I had day by day by day learned to follow my father's mind. Now, what can I do with that? I can read people, but I'm aware of it. I can go to spiritual places, but I'm aware of it. I can have lines in my head. I can create games. One of the best things I ever created was floor checks. I can play them out in my head because I can watch people move to different places and cluster and do all the things they do in my head. So I can pop around and see it, but I'm aware I'm doing it. And I'm not sh that is related to dissociation, but I think of dissociation as non-conscious.
An unconscious awareness.
Non-conscious, no awareness.
No awareness. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not conscious awareness.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the question would be, do you feel like there has to be a certain level of unhealthy coping that one might need to engage in to kind of s kick off their healing?
You got that to whatever it was that's driving the. When you say that again, it's just
Unhealthy
too.
coping.
But would you make that personal? Would you take that leap? You don't have to, but I'll be able to follow you.
I mean, a matter of this does someone, if they're first starting off on their healing journey and they're kind of touching all these things that are really painful and hard to look at, like, is there an element of I kind of gotta allow myself to have some an outlet, or that might not be the healthiest for me in order to, I don't know, be able to go there at all? Or I don't know if that makes sense, but
And what would an example of that less than healthy outlet be? Because my answer would be yes, but I'm just curious. I mean, is it, Netflix?
it could be food, phone, Netflix, like
Yes. You have hit on something that I think would help tons of people if we talk about it, because this is such a big subject, Andrea. I'm going to digress slightly, but it'll make the point. I've been married for 50 years to my husband, right?
Have you guys ever done a podcast together?
No.
I really would love to do that. I don't know if it's been him in the background, but I've been seeing somebody back there,
Oh, has he been going back and
I've been
forth?
thinking about, like, I would really love to have
Is
both of you on
it a
sometime.
man
I
in the
couldn't tell.
background?
I don't look. I
Okay.
just see somebody, so.
Oh, he is a tall man if you see that person, but I think it might be somebody else.
So
I'd be
you've been
happy to
married
do
for
it.
30 years or whatever you said. How many years?
50, 50,
50. Jeez.
50.
So just like healing, learning isn't one size fits all. And if school wasn't exactly your happy place growing up and it's not your kids either, then you'll love knowing there's now a better way with Time for Learning. So Time for Learning is an online homeschooling platform that offers curriculum from pre-K all the way to 12th grade that gives families the flexibility to shape learning around real life. So let's say your family wants to do some traveling or your kid wants to participate in a hobby that doesn't fit into traditional school hours. This is schooling that you can do anywhere at any time. Or perhaps your kid only likes doing math on Mondays. You can set it up to where they only do one subject each day, or you can mix in different subjects each day. Plus, parents get tons of tools like activity planners and transcript templates that help keep everything organized. And they've been trusted by over 1 million students for over 20 years, y'all. So curious if Time for Learning is right for your family? Well, visit timeforlearning.com. That's time, the number four, learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms.
We knew each other when we were children. When we got together at 23 and 24, it was just sort of like instant. And we have been through all stages of a marriage. And people, sometimes my clients will look at us and sort of, how do you do it? How did you do it? How this, how that? And they imagine this couple who just kind of goes, because we were both therapists at one point. My husband was for a while, I still am. They imagine that we just for every time sit down and go, honey, can we talk this out? I feel this and this and this, and now I'd love to listen to your feelings. No, we fight, we bug each other, but we've just learned kind of how to fight less. We've learned how to let it go sooner. And at about maybe about 10 years ago, we looked at each other and sort of thought, we're going to end up resolving this anyway. Why don't we just forget about it now? And at that point, we just stop taking ourselves so seriously. So, what does happiness look like? What does functional look like? It looks like a moment after moment of what you look at as dysfunction, right? So, I think we've gone way too far in our perfectionism, overamped American, get the best of everything kind of way to not accept. Life on life's terms. Life's terms. I think that any kind of recovery path is going to incorporate all kinds of, slips and slides in and out. And I think any life will. I don't have any desire to be perfect. I just want to get good at the emotional sobriety. I want to live in four, five, and six, not 0 to 10. That's when I came up with that graph. The guy in Canada, there are like 500 people in the room, and I saw everybody kind of go and start writing things down. And he walked up to me and he said, "Keep that." No one really knew what you were talking about. Once you did that, they all got it. And that we don't want four, five, and six. We want perfection. And perfection is an illusion. And it's not something to go after. So we've been sold a bill of goods in our culture, and maybe even in certain religions. And perfection is being in the moment and being adequate, being spontaneous, staying awake. Perfectionism you have to have is a head trip. Because it doesn't exist in the moment to moment reality of life. Can I just turn this and you can edit it out if you want to, but that you see Central Park? All the children in the snow? That's perfect. There's snow, they're little, they have a snow day, they have slides, they drag their parents out, you know. It's to see perfection in what is. My husband and I followed a Swami for many years, and he used to say, learn to see perfection in what is. And that is a re-understanding of perfection. Look for it in what is already surrounding you and what is already inside of you. But I think that many people would lead happier lives if they could live with a little more, I wouldn't call it dysfunction. I would just call it the skins and arrow, the what's and arrows that flesh is heir to. The just let things happen and know when they have to be addressed. But if you're in a perfectionist state of mind, you won't know it anyway, because you won't be in the moment. You'll be in some head trip. And you'll want to fix, and you'll be operating out of your own history. And so I think the letting go of the idea of a perfect recovery might allow a lot more people to recover. And not to be so hard on yourself when you goof up, because we all goof up like all the time. All the time. It's not about not goofing up, it's about repair. It's about repair, 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 repair. Not about do you fall, it's about do you get up.
Was going to say that speaks to just like through the lens of IFS, just the curiosity and compassion.
Well, I could add something there. I think the brilliance of IFS that Dick has given us is that you have parts. That, do you want me to give you a personal example? It's kind of a weird one. I was speaking, I was in Dublin actually, and there was an IFS person and a polyvagal person. And the polyvagal person, and it's on video somewhere, was saying, gosh, I'm speaking in front of you, and that's a little challenging because she was imagining I was judging her or whatever. I was there to learn. And anyway, we got to be pals, and the three of us were walking along, and I talked about feeling insecure for a moment. Now, I love public speaking and public, doing psychodrama and all that kind of stuff. I enjoy it. It's second nature, but I was talking about an insecure moment, and she said, yeah, but so that's different from what you said, which earlier, which was, yeah, I like to, and the IFS person jumped in and said, that's only a part of her. That was just a part of her. She just said it for a part of her. And she said, look at her out there. She's so, she loves it. She's so good at it. So the idea that I could be a public person and enjoy that, but have a little part inside of me that is saying, do you still like me, or did I do something that bugged somebody, or all that kind of thing? It's IFS lets it be both, and those parts can coexist. We can have an exiled part that is cozying up to a protector part and knows itself and can still share its insecurity. God help us if we can't keep that part alive and keep that little insecure part. That's what a 50-year marriage will do for you if you become get more note in the life, I mean, I can always be little with my husband. I can always be little and insecure in myself.
IFS has been really life-changing for me and my community, like everyone's obsessed with IFS. You know what's really interesting is I have a member of my community and her husband are doing couples therapy, but it's like I can't remember the specific name of it, but it really is like it's like IFS couples therapy, which is really interesting.
The parts communicating and getting to know
Yeah, it's
each other.
basically
And
like
yeah.
identifying which parts are showing up like in their tension.
But see, that's where the brilliance is. So you can interrupt that moment of conflict and say, oh my God, this is my insecure part again. What I really want to say to you is, I'm scared that you're going to go, that you're getting sick of me. I'm scared that I'm going to do this all again and I'll just get left. Or, and then you can relax again and say, what does that part want to say to me right now? What did your whole, what does that part need right now? And your partner could say, what does that part need from me right now? And then you can just say reassurance, and the partner is free to say, look, part, don't worry about that. It's not on the table right now. You know, so get that. And Dick always uses permission. May I have, can I ask you to take a step back and watch? You know, so you can reconfigure these inner parts and give them permission to speak or let them refuse to speak. And you can bring in the exiles. That's a very freeing thing to be able to do.
Yeah, and I think it is great because it's really taking the concept of like an inner child, and like you don't just have a one size fits all, you
No,
know? You have lots of them
lots of them.
that show up in
I,
different ways.
yeah, when I do the trauma timeline or the attachment trauma timeline, it's inner child work, but it's inner little baby work, it's inner little toddler work, it's inner little, you know, 6-year-old work, it's inner teenager work, it's inner 50-year-old work, it's whatever. But it quite right, we are many parts. And Moreno's concept was we are many roles. It's the same. Moreno's whole model, Jael Moreno, who created psychodrama,
Psychodrama, yeah.
it's a role-based method, and you can talk, and this is the beauty of psychodrama. I've always been able to talk to any part through a role. You just name the part. You can talk to your dog.
You know what I think is, I was reading, I don't know what, in what book of it was of yours, but when you're talking about psychodrama and bringing other people in to play roles for other people, and just like the sort of I'm not exactly sure how you word it, but basically how it's always like the right person that ends up playing that particular
Oh, Tele.
role.
Tele. Oh, you've done some good reading. Tele is a psychodramatic concept that is what connects us with people psychically. And do you want me to give you a really extreme example of Tele?
Please.
So I was at a treatment wake for myself, maybe, you know, in my 30s, I'm in my mid 70s. And I was working with sexual abuse in my family. My father was sexually abusive, not particularly of me, of others in my family. I was actually very close to him, but learned as a small child to keep this part away, to bring, let this part come. It's pretty crazy, but I was able to do it because I needed what he was that was so good. And I wanted nothing to do with this other side. And it was a drunk part for him. It was not sober behavior. So I wanted to look at that this week. And I went around and he said, who could play your father? And I went into this state where my tele was just absolutely kicked in. I was reading everything and everybody. And I tried one person, and then I looked at them. I said, oh no, I'm so sorry. That's, you're not right for the part. And I think I chose four times, right? And finally, when I looked around the room, and it was as if my tele went down in letters and layers, boom, boom, boom. I just looked at this man and said, you're my father. Would you play my father? Now, the therapist, not understanding theory in psychodrama, said, you're pretty controlling to have to choose so much. No, in psychodrama, you choose till you make that choice. He just didn't have the training for that. And, I did the psychodrama. I had the week. It was blah, blah, blah. At the end of the week, the man came out as a pedophile. I mean, it's not, you know, his name isn't attached to any of that stuff, but I made exactly the right choice based on Tele. I chose five times or four times because I wanted to stay that far away from that. But I eventually embodied that role and spoke to it. Without
How
even
did that
knowing.
come out?
He wanted to tell the whole community. He just told on himself in front of the community. I had no idea. I would have never guessed.
How was that received?
With love, with congratulations, with, I probably hugged the guy. I mean, you know, I hugged my father. I loved my father.
So were you the golden child to your dad?
Yeah, I was.
And did you have a, you obviously probably had a sibling that was the scapegoat to him?
Well, I think my brother might say he was, but I'd have to ask. So I don't know. I don't have an identified scapegoat in my head. I have an identified mascot, but my mother would call me the mascot. My sister was 10 times funnier than I was. I would call her the mascot. I would call me a lost child and a hero. I think we're combinations of roles and we cycle through.
I had just interviewed two sisters that are a part of my community, and their dad was a narcissist. And so one of them was the dad, the scapegoat, and the other one was like the golden child to the dad. And as kids growing up, they were, pitted against each other, like really, really made to dislike each other. And so it's really beautiful that out of like four siblings, they're probably the two least likely to come together in the healing journey, but they have, and it's really, really amazing to witness.
You must feel wonderful about that.
Yeah, it was a great interview. It was
I
really
mean,
awesome.
that's the dream, right? That's the dream for all of us.
I've done a couple of episodes where with siblings. Like I did one with like four siblings together, and those are always just so interesting, just to hear the differing perspectives of like, what their childhood was like. I mean, you can just have vastly different experiences as your siblings growing up in the same exact home.
When I was 30 exactly, I was always dragging my family into therapy from the time I was in my 20s. This time we were about to move to England, and I told my mother, we have a little window here. Can we get everybody to come? And she was always reluctant, but I pushed it, and she was on the knew someone called Sharon Wegscheider Cruz, who had started this movement. She wrote Choice Making, she wrote Another Chance. She was a big pioneer in that period. And so mom hired Sharon to come to our house. We all piled into the basement, right? And you could be 12 and up, so there were like a lot of us in the room. And the first exercise she did, or maybe the third, said, sculpt the family as you see it. And it was a completely life-altering moment for me to realize we were all living and growing up in a different family. And that's not just ACAs, that's everybody. That's ordinal position, it's birth position. And we need to honor that. That no two people are growing up in the same family, just with the same cast of characters, but we come in with different everything. So I think what you're doing is really important.
Did you have any particular pivotal moments in really having more of an understanding of what one of your siblings experienced?
I think my pivotal moment is much more what I experienced. I was lost in all of their experiences. I think when I thought, oh my God, I am a person too. We do these things called social atoms. Sharon was doing a sculpture, but it arises from a social atom that you would do on paper. And my big awareness was to just to include myself on my own social atom. Everybody else, I knew just where to put them, and I felt a lot for them. I think it was feeling for myself that I was short on, because I was the youngest.
Yeah, I just sent out a newsletter last night about how being like overly understanding is a trauma response.
Oh, fawning, right? Fawning. I suppose that you would call it a fawning response in me, but fawning was, fight, flight, freeze, fawn for your listeners. And fawning for me as the youngest made a lot of sense, because I would, if I wanted to get in with the older kids, I had to do what they asked. And if I had my own preferences, I just didn't get in.
What was the age difference between you and your oldest sibling?
That was a good question, because we had a baby who died. So that at we never met her. I wasn't born yet, but my brother, my sister, a 4-year gap wherein that baby died, and wherein my family cracked in half, I think. And then my, should I elaborate this? It tells a
Please.
story. So then my sister was born, and then I was born. So here's the layout of the land. My brother and sister were the perfect family, right? My mother really, they were beautiful looking, they were successful, they had the perfect family. We were Greek American, we were top of the heap in that culture. Perfect family. Then my mother had a baby who had a condition that met her. She had a, it was life-threatening, and she passed in 2 days. And I think that cracked my family. It broke the illusion of being perfect. My mother was grieving but didn't know. My father couldn't help. He was 19 years older. He felt she was as much a daughter as a wife, I think. He took her to Canada to help her. He never even addressed his own grief, I'm sure. Because in the face of my mother's narcissistic grief, no one else was there. He learned there from a friend, a Greek friend, to just drink a little bit, just to take the edge off. Well, my father is a genetic alcoholic, and once it was a little bit, it was
Oh,
everything.
interesting.
So that's where Dad's addiction began, and that's where the family
Wow.
was no longer perfect, right? And then here's the proof that my sister's name is Becca. Her Greek name, we all had these long Greek names that were anglicized to something shorter. My brother Nicholas was Nick. My sister Mariana became Cootsie from the Cootsie Coo, and that was the era where everybody was called Bambi and Cootsie and Cutesy, all those names. The baby died, and she was on her birth certificate. She never had a name. Her name was Baby Girl Barbatsis. My sister, Evangelia Elaine, named after my father's sister and my mother. That was her big Greek name. Her nickname was Bebeka, which means baby girl in Greek. They shortened it to Becca. But what had the birth certificate said? She was baby girl Barbatsis. So Becca became the replacement child, named basically dead baby. I mean, she was named after the baby that died, only it was turned from English into Greek. And then the name Becca, of course, sounds completely English, American. So you have to really tease that one out to figure it out. And then I was sort of named after my grandparents, who my mother said, "Hey, you didn't name anybody after my parents." So they were called Christ and Anna, and I'm Christiana. And my mother shortened that to Tian. And that replacement child never got to be herself. And she was really, I think, quite, she's passed now. She was rather borderline, extremely fun and effervescent, but really, all over the place. And I really think that, and then she called me one time, Becca, when we were like tw in our 20s, and she said, "You won't believe what mom just told me." And I said, "What?" And she said, "We were talking about you and me and all of the kids. And mom actually said, by the time you were born, after the baby died, I tried really hard not to get too close to you, too attached to you." And she actually said it in words. And my sister said, "Well, it really worked."
It showed.
Yeah, she did not get attached to us.
Wow.
She just didn't. And she tried not to because to protect herself. And she didn't question it because of her narcissism. She thought, good solution. I don't want to hurt like that ever again. So I just won't get so attached to these two. And she handed us off to Nick and Cootsie and to the help and to, and me, I found my father, who really did realize what was happening and tried his best to attach to both of us. But by the time he figured it out, I think he was better attached to me.
Was your dad, did he not drink at all before that?
Not really. I mean, my mother says varying things, but I remember a very sober guy, but I was just a little girl. And no, he didn't have a. That was the beginning, and he was still quite sober for many years.
How
But then
quick did
he
that
learned,
escalation happen?
not very fast. I mean, after he retired, I think as life got harder, as my mother became more independent, as she got older. I mean, remember he was something of a pedophile, so he was very screwed up sexually,
Man.
every direction.
And
As he got sicker,
how old were you when he passed away?
23, and I was the only one with him.
Well,
I mean,
did they divorce?
they divorced. I got my dad when I was about 4. My mother just handed him off to me. And whenever he was drunk or out of control, she'd say, "Honey, go in and try to calm your father down. You're so good with him." That's why I said that thing in my book. I was so good at my job. I took him on. That was my job.
How old were you when they got divorced?
A 10th or 11th grade. It's kind of a fog. My mother thinks 11th. It feels to me like 10th. She's probably right.
Was there any sort of a sense of relief related to it?
Yes. As I look back now, Andrea, I realize it was the making of me. I realize, thank God they got a divorce, because the thing that I think it is a real problem for kids is when parents hate each other, and the kids, mom and dad, do you really want to know that I've never said out loud why
Please.
this happened? So my father used to come in my room at night. Forgive me if I, get a little weird as I tell this. I've never told it. I never let him lay a hand on me, right? But when I was in 9th grade or 10th grade, developing, right, pretty developed little nubile teenager, he and I had taken over my sister's room. I think he would get drunk and not know where he was, and he was coming upstairs to see what he could. And I would hear these footsteps on my, it was just, the way drunk people sound when they. And we had so many flights of stairs that he had come up, he'd come up 8 flights to get there. And I tried, at first I pretended I was asleep. That, who knows how long I did that. Then he wouldn't stop coming. And I knew I had to get rid of him. So I talked to all my Greek friends and I said, "Teach me how to swear in Greek." And these guys taught me all the worst swear words. They go, "You want to learn how to swear in Greek?" But I said, "Yeah, I really need this." So they taught me how. I practiced. I had a little list of swear words and I waited to hear the steps. And I will show you what I did. I was sleeping and I went like this. And I started swearing at him in Greek because I knew that would terrify him. And he turned around and ran. And I thought, okay, great. I figured it out. I'll swear at him in Greek. And this is real kid think, right? But I had to come up with something. And then he kept coming up. And eventually I thought, I'm never going to get to sleep again. I told 2 friends, they both went and talked to their parents, and they both said, "You can come and live with us." So I talked to my mother and I said, "Mom, I'm going to move out. Dad won't stop coming up to my room." And my mother never did anything about any of this. So she said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, Mary's parents said I could live with them. Anne's parents said I could live with them." She said, "Give me a minute." She called my grandmother and she said, "Tiana's got to come there." So she knew what was going on. She just didn't handle it with Dad. She got me a place to stay with my grandmother, who was 2 blocks away. and actually lived closer to my friends than we did, you know, 2 blocks closer. And we used to sneak out at night and bicycle and meet each other. So part of me, the teenager part, thought, okay, that'll work, you know, I'll get out and I'll. And I went to live with him, and that's what started the divorce. And I know why. As sad as it is to say, it's because I was going to break the truth. I was going to start talking. And as long as everything stayed under wraps, Andrea, it was okay in our house. As long as nobody talked. You know, Claudia Black, don't trust, don't talk, don't feel. Well, that was our home. And I wanted to feel, and I wanted to trust, and I wanted to talk, and I was going to talk. I was talking. I wasn't like this kid determined to flip the lid. I wasn't rebellious. I just wanted a decent night's sleep. And really, by keeping my father away, I protected the person I was the closest to. I protected my relationship with him, with the, is it the Dr. Jekyll? Is I can't remember if it's which one. It's Dr. Jekyll I was close to. It's Mr. Hyde. I kept it. Do I have that straight?
I don't know. I think probably,
Yeah,
I don't know, probably.
it
I don't know. You
may.
think that Jekyll sounds like more nefarious,
I
but like
know,
the
he
doctor, I
does.
think, cancels it out. But
Yes.
yeah, you know, they kind of don't
You're
work
so
together. It's like the
funny.
doctor sounds like the norm, but then the Jekyll sounds bad. And
But this is what I love about being an ACA. I mean, your line of reasoning is exactly perfect in my mind. It's zany and it's accurate. Yeah, it's kind of brilliant.
well, it's insane to think about, like, just the time it was, and that you could go to a friend and, like, I'm assuming they're like telling their parents, like, what actually is happening.
Well,
And when
you
we think
want
about
to.
it today, like, what would happen? It would be reported, and it's just
But
mind
thank
blowing.
God it wasn't. See, that's the thing. Like, first of all, the one friend had two alcoholic parents, so they could have been drunk and just said, yeah, she can come and live here. And I didn't want to go there. My other friend had a mother who was the sweetest woman on earth and had grown up an orphan. And she just said, you tell Tian to come over here. And my friend used to call me Tiani, and she said, Tiani, my mother said you can come and live here. Just pack your suitcase and we'll come and get you. I mean, it was so. And that's how I got out. That's how I recognized.
When did you become aware that your dad was being sexually abusive towards your sister?
When I was in my 40s or 50s.
Okay, so like when you were pushing him off, like in that circumstance, like you didn't have the awareness at the time. Oh,
No idea.
interesting.
No idea. And I don't talk about this because I don't want to tell anybody else's story. But here we are, and I'm saying it. And I mean, I think I have a right to tell my part of the story. And I didn't know. I didn't know anything. I just knew my father was coming into my room.
Interesting.
And by the way, just to so there's no ghosts. I had remember being touched by him in a way I didn't like as a like a 2 year baby. And I was hypnotized once and I said, I'm going to tell my mommy, and I think I probably said that to him and it stopped. So there was nothing that went on. I mean, we really did have a relationship without, but it was the drunkenness progressed, and that's how it went.
Do you think that your mom had an awareness of it the whole time?
I think certainly part of the time she says that I didn't know, but my mother said she didn't know about a lot of things. And I believe her naivete because my father was also at the same time, as long as I'm telling her everything else, he was going to bathhouses and, you know, going with men and women, right? Now, I doubt women played much of a role then. I think he kept it very contained. And in, you know, the Greek culture can be a little bit, they might see homosexuality from the ancient end as a bit different. But she must have gotten pretty used to going to bed at night. And not that this happened all the time, I just don't think it did. But could she have been blind to it? My God, my mother was the queen of denial. Just I and she would rewrite things in your presence. And by the end of it, she was so good, you sort of bought her story. But eventually, I didn't buy her story. But then I started building my own when it fell apart because there was no one else. There, I remember going, I used to come in the house, we had a beautiful house and these wonderful chimes that went bum 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 bum, bum bum bum. So I would always come in the door and say hello to hear all the sweet voices say hi, Tiani, or whatever. And I came in, I think it was in 9th or 10th grade, and it was empty once again when I said hello. And I remember sitting myself down and just saying, don't say it anymore, Tian, nobody's going to answer, just don't say it. And that's how it went. But in my end was my beginning, because in the end of this huge dysfunction, I began to find myself, and I learned to manage my own life, and I turned out I was good at it.
I'm the vulnerability whisperer.
You are very, I've never told this story, Andrea, but also I feel like I have a long relationship with you, and I feel it's safely held and heard, and that's a gift. And if you have that gift to bring to our community, God bless you.
I feel like I wish I could create another podcast. Like, I'd have to see what the like recording laws are like in the state of Florida, but like the conversations that I have with strangers are just so, it's so fascinating, you know? People
Well,
feel
you
really comfortable
find
sharing with me.
you're, yeah, you're very, the questions you ask are very, very well thought through, and they're very perspicacious, and they're interesting, and they require the lots going through your mind before you ask the question.
Thank you. You're my favorite guest. Okay, is there anything about the book that you haven't shared that you'd like to?
I think what I'd like to leave people with is that recovery is a beautiful spiritual journey. Don't worry about it. Just take your first step
No
and
big
fall
deal.
down. No big deal.
No
But
biggie,
do
folks.
go
Just
into the
come on.
12-step community, is that what I would suggest, or some community, because you don't want to do it alone. You don't want to figure it out by yourself, and you don't need to. And when the first time I went to an Al-Anon meeting, not the first time, the first year, I didn't worry about the God thing. I didn't worry about it. I didn't worry about the, it was enough for me to not clear the room when I opened my mouth and told the truth. That's all I needed that year. That I really thought when I told the truth, I would look around and people would be, I was sure about this, they'd be quietly picking up their belongings and gathering themselves and leaving. Now, that is a sort of a dark narcissism of dysfunction too, right? Why would it occur to me that they're not there listening to me, they're there listening to everybody, and that I don't have the power to clear the room. But I thought in my family I somehow had the power to clear the room, and I had the power to make them all mad at me. So at the same time as we're little kids cowering under our cognitive distortions and feeling it's my fault, we're also saying I have the power to get all this hate in my direction. I don't have the power to get all the love. I don't have the power to get all the hate. But Al-Anon freed me of that and a zillion other things.
Did you frequent ACA meetings much?
No, because in my day, when it was starting out, everybody was so angry. And I just liked Al-Anon with its more of a balanced, and also people weren't owning enough of their own stuff. In Al-Anon, the big focus is, if for every one point finger you're pointing here, there are three back to yourself. And, look at own your own stuff first. And the ACA meetings weren't at that place
I
yet.
think it still is that way to an extent. It's a lot of victimhood.
I'm not into victimhood. It gets you nowhere. It's like going down, the wrong path. And I understand it, and I would work with it psychodramatically effectively. But everybody who is a stuck-in victim should write a letter to the victim inside of them and consider it a part in IFS language. Consider it a part that you will allow to talk, and you will give the stage and permission to speak and all, and you'll ask permission if they want to speak. But it's a part. Don't, it's not your life. And it's too powerful a position to get stuck in, but it's a dark power.
Yeah, and I think that there is a way to like express and touch upon the ways in which we've been victimized, but not be in victimhood.
Yeah, and think about the rest of the world. Think about Ukraine. You want to talk about victims. There are so many people, who are true victims. And we were victims in a true way too. But look at the options we've got. Just look at them. Keep your eye on the prize.
Well, I think though
Stick.
the thing about it is that it's rooted in trauma. That I think that's an aspect of it, right? Like the victimhood is like, I don't like part of that is just like a built-in trauma response, I think.
Well, so is the culprit,
Yeah.
because trauma loves a culprit. One of my favorite AA sayings, it's so funny. The piece of shit at the center of the universe. Do you know that one?
What, like an
It's
inferiority? Yeah, like
well,
essentially that
it's like
egomaniac with an
in
inferiority complex, but a funnier way of saying it.
AA. It's just that alcoholics have to really grapple with this one. That's why sometimes alcoholics can get such great recovery. Because if they do recover, they've had to really look at their own darkness and their terrible behavior and own it. But if they can't stop owning it, if they get stuck in being a piece of shit in the center of the universe, then it's just turning that place into a kind of a narcissism. It's a dark narcissism. And they're insisting on being the worst person in the room. That's just the flip side. That's not taking responsibility. It's sucking up all the oxygen. So I think as ACAs, we have mirrored the alcoholic. So we've ingested that template into ourselves, and we want to get unstuck from the full template. And victimhood is part of the template because it justifies the addiction.
So true. All right, well, we'll get everyone pre-ordering their Growing Up with Addiction.
Thank
I'm
you.
excited for people to read it. It's great. It's kind of like a workbook too, like with good questions in it. So
Yeah.
good work.
Thank you.
You think it'll work?
Just let it all go. What's making you slow now? Just let it.